Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're going back to Stockholm. But listen, we keep doing it, Martin. We keep going on and we keep forgetting. These pods need support. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
Honest to God, mean this. If people don't sign up to the Patreon, I'm doing all of these naked. I swear I will. I swear I will.
Listen, you do realize these go out in audio form, you dope.
Yeah, but it doesn't stop me doing them naked. I'll make Tony uncomfortable. I promise I'll make him uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I give you my word, I will do naked podcasts where Tony has to look at me in the nude. I promise you.
Anyway, I'll be turning your mic and your camera off. Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined on the line by returning world champion, Stockholm's favourite son. I know, Philip O'Connor. Philip, our man in Stockholm, how are you keeping?
Jesus, I think I've completely lost my marbles lately, but I'm brilliant, Tony. And I have to say, it's brilliant to be talking to the two of you again, because it's great to see Martin looking so well and clothed, I think is the way I'd put it, you know?
Yeah, I have a nightgown and a t-shirt on. Yeah.
It's been a little while. We chat on and off, but it's been unbelievable in terms of, you know, just as the canary in the coal mine, you were sitting in Sweden and, you know, everybody looked at Sweden and said, well, they're trying something different. You know, the idea of herd immunity around COVID, and it wasn't, let's be fair, it's a different kind of concept, what we would call herd immunity in you know, it's not the UK, Boris Johnson, let's open the pubs and do push-ups together. It was very much a Scandinavian style. But Philip, do you want to give us a quick idea of how that's kind of washed out?
Yeah. Well, Boris Johnson was basically his version of herd immunity, like, was, you know, let's do nothing. Let's just let this shit happen and let's get on with it, right? Mm. Whereas the Swedes, obviously, anybody who's made an IKEA bookshelf will know that there's a thought process behind everything that goes on here, right? And that was the thing that amazed me, Tony, was because, like, what happened to me personally was, obviously, I work as a journalist here and I work on a lot of sport and that kind of thing. And all that just went fucking straight out the window as soon as the pandemic started. Now, I know the Premier League has been back and rugby is starting and all that kind of thing, but, you know, cast your mind back to the time when there was nothing on the TV whatsoever. Mm. So I then started to cover the pandemic. So I was down at the press conferences with Anders Tegnell every day, who's the state epidemiologist. And he's a really, really accessible guy. So, you know, that's the thing with public life in Sweden, is you can actually get hold of a politician or, you know, a quote-unquote celebrity or something like that. It's actually relatively easy. And they'll actually explain things to dumbasses like me in ways that I can almost understand, you know. So I interviewed him a lot at the time, and he was very, very specific, because we all tend to think of this thing as just popping up out of nowhere, and all of a sudden the governments and states and agencies were forced to react, right? Well, what Tegnell has been doing for donkey's years as the state epidemiologist has been preparing for this exact situation. Now, different countries have done it in different ways, but he has taken the experience from Ebola in West Africa in the mid-1990s all the way through. His predecessor, Yuan Yaseka, worked with AIDS and HIV, and all the learnings from those pandemics. This is Yaseka's fifth pandemic, I think he told me. So they took everything from that. So everything they did was based on what they'd learned from all these previous situations. And that led to a situation where they said, no, we're not going to lock society down, right? What we're going to do is we're just going to try to control people by sort of, you know, using this sense of, you know, your own sense of responsibility towards society and, you know, trusting that you will behave yourself properly and thereby limiting the spread, right? Now, how that has fallen out, and, you know, it's already taken me 3 minutes to sort of explain that. What Tegnell would say, and also what I would say, is it's too early to tell, right? Because we were looking for answers from him, you know, in March, you know, on St. Patrick's Day. You know, he's putting a microphone under his nose going, you know, well, tell me, when will this be over and when can I go on holiday? And he was going, look, pal, this is not going to happen. We're going to be living with this for a long time. It's too early. It's too early. It's too early. Now, if we sort of fast forward 4 or 5 months, we know an awful lot more about the disease. We know an awful lot more about how it transmits, but we still know nothing. We don't know the effects of it. We don't know how it works. We don't know, you know, what the long-term effects are. We don't know why it doesn't seem to present in children. We don't know why they don't seem to be super spreaders, because teachers at Dublin seem to be getting it as much. And yes, it's still, you know, sort of traveling through in domestic situations, large family situations. That has really wrecked this country. The other thing that they utterly, utterly, catastrophically failed to do in this country was protect the elderly. Now that, Tegnell told me, was one of the two pillars, right? They had two pillars. One was sort of, you know, wash your hands, keep your distance, try not to use public transport, work from home, home if you can. And the other pillar was to protect the elderly. And that has been a disgraceful failure in this country, as it has been in many countries. Now, we will eventually find out why that happened, right? But the very basics of it are that this is a very, very aggressive virus. And the older you are, the less chance you have of surviving. That's just a simple, the simple scientific explanation of it. It's just young people are strong enough to deal with it. Older people aren't, right? Now, how it got into nursing homes, we can get into PPE, we can get into hygiene, we can get into casual labor, we can get into zero-hour contracts and all those things. But that's coming further down the line. At the moment, we're still learning to deal with those things. Now, if you look at the figures or the statistics in Sweden at the moment, it's actually pretty okay, right? But there's a number of reasons for that as well. When you get to midsummer, which is like the third, or I think it's the second or third Friday in June, This country changes, right? You live in a country where crowded house would have had, we have four seasons, not in one day, but in one year. So, you know, summer is a very, very specific time and people do specific things. So what they're doing at the moment is nobody's sitting in an office or on an underground train. Everybody's out in the sticks. They're going swimming. They're out in a forest somewhere. They're staying away from one another, right? So that's probably why you don't have a huge rate of transmission at the moment. But the school's actually opened, as we're talking here on a Monday evening, the school's actually opened today. Okay. And that means then that a lot of parents will go back to work, and it may be, you know, whereas they might have worked from home up until now and then had 4 or 5 weeks off, they'll be going back into an office environment and that. And we're also at the point where we have to remember that there are phases, both sociologically and psychologically, in this, right? So if you go back to the very start of the pandemic, we were all afraid, nobody wanted to do anything, and you were sort of hosing down your groceries in your garden, right? Now, you gradually learn to live with these things, and your behavior then changes because you start to get cocky. You go, it's kind of like being on a diet, and you go, one bar of dairy milk is not going to hurt me, right? And then all of a sudden you're sitting in front of the fire with the curtains closed, eating 5 of them, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we are now. We kind of decided, we're invincible. If it hasn't got me now, how bad can it be, etc. And it's keeping the mind focused is the really, really difficult thing. And I've noticed that Swedes are already coming back to this thing of, look at lads, don't forget to wash your hands, not touch your face. Do you remember that? When we weren't allowed to touch our face? All those things. And, we're now going back to those things again because they're really, really good here. You know, if I'm obviously following what's happening in Ireland, not least through your brilliant podcast, which people should be going to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and paying for, right? Following the messaging there. And the messaging in Ireland, to me, lads, is very confused, right? So in Ireland, it seems that we got to the point where, whether it be lobbyists or politicians or businesses said, we can't deal with this anymore. We have to start opening up. And you know the way when you were a kid and you were playing a game and then all of a sudden you started making up the rules as you went along? Yeah. That's not how this shit works, right? This COVID virus does not care if a meal costs €9 or €8.50, right? It does not care about many, many things, arbitrary things, whether your pub serves food or not, Pouring shots into somebody's gob off a bar in Dame Street is probably not to be recommended,
Mr. Brightside does not stop the virus.
No, exactly, I mean, I'd run a mile from that song, so it might help. You'll find me out in the forest somewhere, so it might protect me, but not too many others, So all of those things, the Swedes are now going back to that sort of reason-based, science-based way of thinking. And what Tegnell, the last time I was speaking to Tegnell was probably about 2.5 weeks ago. And he was saying that thing of, look at, every day there's new data from new countries, right? Yes. And if you look over the long term, he was saying to me, the whole point of what we're doing here is so that it will be sustainable. Right. So he reckons that the Swedes can do this over a longer time. I've often described social distancing as being a synonym for living in Scandinavia because they're not the huggiest, kissiest people in the world when it comes down to it. So it's actually quite easy. And then for 6 months of the winter, you're not going to go outside anyway. I just can't stand spending a half an hour putting on clothes just to go for a pint. They're just not arsed. I'll watch Netflix instead. So that these cultural things make it a little bit easier, But I do think that Tegnell does not see this as full time. I think he sees this as, we'll do, and now I don't mean to be crass, lads, because people have lost relatives and friends and people have suffered illnesses, but I don't think he's going to look at the body count now and say, look at, we've won or we've lost or we've done better than others. And one of the things that was brought up often was how it was dealt with in New Zealand. So if you go back to when New Zealand was the best boy/girl in the class, and basically what happened was they took in a flight that I think came out of one of the London airports and it had two people on it who happened to be asymptomatic and infected, and all of a sudden it started to break out there again. So they were COVID-free. And then they started to break out there again. Now, Tegnell is not the kind of guy. Sometimes you will have what they call självgodhet in Swedish, which is a kind of a little bit sort of, you know, oh, look at us, aren't we great? We did everything better than everybody else, you know. But that's very understated. It doesn't go over into arrogance in the way, you know, sometimes the Dutch can get that very sort of arrogant look in their eye when they're explaining these things, you know. So the Swedes will be sort of sitting there being a bit smug, but not saying anything about it. Now, I don't think that's the case when they look at, say, South Korea or New Zealand. I think there's too much of the humanitarian in them to look at other people suffering and say, fucking serves them right, you know. They wouldn't be in the Varadkar class of doing those kinds of things, you know. But I do think that Tegnell would look at this and say, look, this is a very long game. This illness, this virus is going to change the way we behave. It's going to change the way we think. It's going to change the way we interact. I've already sort of seen a massive impact on people's mental health and how they deal with, you know, their own, you know, there's an existential crisis going on for many people thinking, what if I get it? I was talking to an Icelandic football player called Kolbein Sigþórsson, who was part of the squad that played at Euro 2016. Mm. And Kolbein had it. And he was telling me like 2-3 months after he had his gun, man, I don't feel great. I still don't feel. And this is a professional athlete, lads. This is a man in the prime of his life. Never the fastest, but he could always go out there and play for 90 minutes wherever he played and that kind of thing. And he's still not right. You know what I mean? And it was an unusual conversation because usually athletes are not really willing to discuss their health in any way publicly, you know. But he was going, look, I just don't feel like myself, you know. So we're going to be a long term living with this. I don't think that we will have, you know, this is like doing the leave-in cert, but you don't get the results until 3 years later, you know, and we're all mad to get it and we all want to know how we did and that kind of thing. But I think most of us actually know, you know, who got the A's and who got the C minus here kind of thing.
You know? And there's going to be that pushback that they keep saying, you know, this is the nonsense. And I mean this as someone who likes to think of it, as you said, through the humanitarian prism, that they say, well, at least Sweden's economy didn't contract as much as others and there's this trade-off. But also, we can't have that argument here in Ireland because Sweden had more critical care beds, more, you know, their health service was better set up. We didn't have that, and we are facing into there are a second lockdown in the Midlands as it is, and that is having impacts on people's well-being. The only thing I really want to just jump into, and I'd be interested to get your opinion on it, is you said the school's open today, and they never closed for children, I think, was under 13, Philip, am I right?
16, yeah.
Yeah, so they never really closed at that stage in Sweden. We're sitting here now with a couple of weeks to go before our school's open, and we just don't feel very confident personally where I'm sitting right now.
This is exactly the point, Tony, that you don't feel very confident. And this, when I talked about the messaging being very unclear and very indistinct, this is where a lot of countries are screwing up, right? So I'll go back to Johan Jasecki. He was the state epidemiologist for many years, and now he's working as a consultant for the public health authority here. And I met him, I don't know if you remember, lads, I was in Portugal just as this pandemic was breaking out at a women's football tournament. And Italy were supposed to play Germany in the final, and the final was cancelled to let the Italian women go home before the whole country was closed down, right? So that was happening, and I was coming back here and going, okay, so I went to meet this guy, Jasecki, because Tegnell was up to his arse and he couldn't talk to me. So I said, okay, who's the next best man? Jasecki. And Jasecki came out and he said to me straight away, he said, children are not super spreaders. The idea that an asymptomatic child can spread this disease is nonsense. They don't have the viral load. They don't have what it takes. If they have symptoms, absolutely it's possible. But if they don't have symptoms, impossible. I went, fuck me, you're pretty sure of yourself there, you know? And I asked him about the schools, and he said, well, hold on, let me turn this back on you, because Boris Johnson was after saying something, you know, how many cases will the Brits need to, you know, to close the schools or open them again? Do they need zero COVID? He said, look, this is fine. This doesn't affect children in any major way. So what happened just after that then was that the Swedes and the Finns decided to start a sort of a collective project between the two. Now, the Finns closed their schools for 8 weeks, lads. They closed them down completely. That's it. We're not doing any more, no graduations, none of this bullshit. And they gradually start to open them up as well. The Danes did the same thing. They gradually start to open the schools after about 5 or 6 weeks, one or the other. But again, with social distancing, visors, you know, at school 2 days a week, all these kinds of things involved, right? So, but it was the study that the Swedes and the Finns did together, right, that turned out to be fascinating. Because it turned out that according to these two public health authorities in two EU countries, that it made absolutely no difference if you closed down or not. Right. So it would appear. Now, I didn't like Jasecki. The way he sort of spoke to me, I found the man to be very, very arrogant, very forthright. I didn't feel that he was able to give me a good enough explanation to be able to pass on some of the information that he gave me. Because, you know, I'm not just going to be a fucking megaphone for some guy who wants to get his name in the paper. Right. If he's saying something, there has to be something to it, you know. But I sort of filtered some of that stuff out, even though he said it. But it turns out that from this study, and again, it's way too early to tell long term what's going on here. But it turns out that he may have been right. And one of the metrics that they used for this study was how many teachers got it in Sweden and how many teachers got it in Finland. Because you would expect that if these classrooms were petri dishes of infection, that then teachers would get it at a higher rate in the country where the schools were kept open, right? That's one thing. And that did not happen. So people involved in caring for young people or in teaching or that kind of thing did not get it. So that's one of the major metrics that they used. The other interesting part is that the Swedes kept the schools open to the age of 16, right? So the upper secondary schools were closed, right? And the interesting thing about that is, now this is still not peer-reviewed or that kind of thing, right? But what they're talking about there is physical maturity, right? At the age of 16, the body is much more adult than it is at 13 or 14, right? And that appears to be the sweet spot for this virus. I was talking to a guy called Jerry McInerney. He's a scientist, an Irish scientist who works over here, right? And I don't know if you saw that story that I did for Reuters TV about Tyson the alpaca. Yeah. Tyson strikes a knockout blow on COVID, right? So they got the COVID, basically the virus, and they put it into this alpaca in Germany called Tyson. And Tyson developed antibodies. And Jerry was able to show me where the receptors were that the COVID virus was trying to attach to the cells, right? And Tyson the alpaca went, oh, I'm not having any of this. His immune system kicked in and he stopped it happening, right? But that appears to be the same or a very similar response to what happens in human beings. But for children, the receptors don't seem to be big enough. That's basically the explanation I got when I did the story about 6 weeks ago, that they just, you know, that their cells just aren't receptive to this particular virus. The virus just goes, I can't find anything to attach myself to here, right? So again, we're still very early in this process, and I am definitely not the man to be interpreting the science on behalf of your listeners. I'm just trying to present to you some of the things that people who are far cleverer than me have told me, and then just some of the, you know, my own personal experience. My daughters are now going back to school. One of them started upper secondary school today. The other is still going to sort of the middle school period. There's no real sort of equivalent. She'd be 14 in September, so they're thereabouts, probably second year in Ireland. So they're going back to school, but she was always there. She was in our classroom every day. No social distancing. They had, when they queued for lunch, because, you know, being a civilized country, they get their lunch in school, which is a good thing, but they were made to stand, like, you know, a week apart, and the salad, or a week apart, a meter apart, and the salad buffet was removed. But that was, you know, the height of what they did in the schools here. So I fully understand, and this is to get back to your point about your lack of confidence, Tony. I also have a tremendous lack of confidence in what's happening in the Irish school system, precisely because it hasn't been communicated to teachers, to principals, to parents, or to children what the expectations are, what the risks are, and what the solutions are. And if you cannot come out as public authorities and explain to people why you should feel safe, then you have to tell them to stay at home. If people cannot behave in a safe way, because I'll be honest, lads, there was an awful lot of kids here who didn't go to school because parents were hearing things and they were making up their own minds and say, look, at online learning was offered here. My wife is a teacher as well. So she was doing classes over Teams. You might have, you know, half the class in the room and the other half are on Teams, and they did it. No, it's not a great solution for either teachers or pupils, but that was offered because people did not have the confidence to do it. But all you can do is give people the tools. You can give them the communication, give them the information, and let them make their own decisions. But if all you have is, well, I don't know, I'm waiting on a thing for the department, I'm not really sure, you know, like, if that's all you have, well, then just tell them to stay at home, because you're not offering people any sort of sense of safety or security.
And that's kind of what I think. I think, you know, we're 104 years on from the Battle of the Somme. And I still think there's that mindset there that, look, we don't know what the enemy's like, but we'll send all our troops over the top. They can walk across no man's land. And if we win, we win. But you're talking about kids. And the people making the same making those decisions are the same arrogant mindset that made the decisions back in 1916. It's very much, let's get this job done, boys, home for Christmas, without thinking of the downside and the consequences of doing something like that.
The last thing on this, sorry, Philip, I do want to come in. The last thing I want to ask you on it is about the fact that, and we've seen this, that despite the higher numbers, the numbers going through and all, people aren't developing this immunity. That's the, you know, and again, caveat that with it's too soon to know all of the details, but it does seem that, you know, there are people walking around who have said, oh, I've had it, and yet I've been tested for the antibodies and I don't have them.
Yeah, this is the thing. I actually did the antibody test, and you know, we'll be getting onto that shortly. I did the antibody test last week, and I'm pretty sure I've had it myself. Mm. I'm pretty sure my 14-year-old has had it, and I'm pretty sure my wife has had it as well. So, but this is the problem, lads, because what Jacek was telling me, that he told me that this would be done by the end of May. He told me this epidemic would be over in Sweden by the end of May, right? Now, the problem is that the antibodies aren't developing the way they should be developing. So, you know, they would have expected by now to have sort of 60% of the people would have come into contact with this thing, right? Mm. So the problem is that, and this is why the science is so ineffective at the moment, right? Because it would appear that it's affecting some people, it's not affecting others, it's infecting some people, and it's not infecting others, right? But they can't work out why certain people are susceptible, why certain people suffer so greatly, why certain people can have it and not even notice, and why certain people don't get it at all. And that's why the caveat of, you know, it's too early, like, I can tell you that, you know, there's a bunch of Irish scientists who live here, and I haven't seen any of them for about 4 or 5 months. They've taken off the parking charges near the labs here. I'm actually going there tomorrow again. But near the labs of the Karolinska Institute, they said, look, nobody needs to pay for parking here. And they're working around the clock to try to find the answers to these things. But the great thing, or, you know, and great again, in inverted commas, about this pandemic is that it might actually finally be teaching us a little bit of humility again, right? We think that we're the greatest thing in the world because we're the greatest thing since sliced bread. We can put men on the moon and everything else like that. But Mother Nature still holds the whip hand. And she is still capable of coming up with things that confuse us and, you know, giving us problems to solve that maybe we're not sort of good enough or smart enough just to deal with just yet. But just, I just want to go back to one point that Martin was making there about the Battle of the Somme. And it's a very interesting one, Martin. When it comes to talking to people in authority, the people who make the decisions, I was asking the question very early on in this whole process. If you're talking about risk and you're talking about people getting sick and people maybe dying, that's fine. I understand that these things are going to happen in a pandemic. I understand. I'm not naive enough to believe that nobody dies in war, nobody dies in a pandemic. But give me a name, right? Tell me one person that you are prepared to sacrifice for this, right? And if you as a public health official also can't do that, then you need to be sort of, you know, restructuring or reanalyzing what you're saying, because the goal has to be as many as possible, as safe as possible. Now, then your reasons for sort of, you know, whatever else you do, if it happens to be the economy, come out and say that. If it happens to be the fact, and the Swedish authorities were very, very solid, they said, we want to keep the schools open, because one of the side effects of not having the schools open would be that we lose frontline personnel. We lose nurses, we lose ambulance drivers, we lose doctors, and we can't afford to do that. So we have to keep offering at least them and plenty of others childcare, the so-called essential professions. We have to keep them, you know, we have to look after their children so that those people can go and do the work that we need them to do. So, you know, I come back to that. And it's like, it's always a good barometer is to be able to say to any politician, okay, who are you willing to sacrifice for this to be able to go on in Dame Lane, well, or to have a rugby match at Lansdowne Road, or for whatever else that might happen?
Well, we've seen that. It's people who work in meatpacking factories and people who live in direct provision, and it's people in, you know, we have the best phrase is, you know, it hasn't shown, it hasn't given us that all in it together spirit. It's exposed the inequalities in our system. That's what it's done.
But that's actually across the board, Tony, because
yes, absolutely.
One of the things I'm trying to work on at the moment, and I think I mentioned this to you before privately, was where I bought a line. Sometimes, you know, even with the best will in the world, you try to use your sort of critical faculties to think about things. And people are saying that, you know, where the area where I live at one point, and probably still is, the hardest hit in terms of the number of infections and the number of deaths, right? And I live in an area where, you know, my neighbors on this side, and I'm pointing to the next door neighbors there, they're from Turkey. Neighbors on the other side, they're from Iran. A lot of the people who live around here are immigrants like myself. And the story that came out at the time was, you know, oh, they didn't get information in their own languages in good time, right? And I went, yeah, that sounds reasonable. And then about 2 days later, I went, hang on a fucking second, right? That's not why this happened at all. The reason that my community was so hard hit was because this pandemic started around about week 9, right? Week 9 means nothing to people who work off calendars. But to Swedes in Stockholm, that's what they call the sports holiday. Kids get a week off and parents bring them up the mountains to go skiing, or they might bring them to, you know, to the Alps. They might bring them to Italy. They might bring them to, you know, somewhere around Bergamo to go skiing, right?
Yeah.
The people who drove them back in the taxis from the airports after the week 9 skiing trips, they're my neighbors. All of my neighbors are taxi drivers. All of my neighbors are bus drivers. All my neighbors are working class people, right? And when I realized what had happened there, I went, this is fucking ridiculous. And the problem is that the Somali Swedish community, they now have their own sort of crisis commission. That's the best translation I have, but it's kind of like an independent tribunal that they set up themselves, because of the level of bullshit that's been put out about, you know, it's like they're blaming us for not being able to speak the language or not be able to understand the culture, when in fact we had no choice but to go out to work. I had no choice but to go out and film press conferences. I had no choice but to be out in the streets. And these people had no choice but to sit in a taxi cab, because at that time there was no economic support. There was nothing like that, you know. And I interviewed one family, and that's exactly what happened. You know, these people live in a big sort of villa, big detached house out in the countryside. All four of them had it, and they had it coming back from Italy. And then, you know, I'm trying to prove, I'm still looking for the taxi driver who drove them home, because I'm going to guarantee you, lads, that taxi driver caught it and he brought it to our part of the city, and that was where pretty much the whole thing started.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a crucial point, because we have seen that, and we did have that conversation off air, Philip. I'm glad you said it, because the simple fact is, a lot of that is, if you're sitting in a taxi, it's the viral load of this thing as well.
Yeah.
If everybody's in and out, it's the viral load. Same thing in those communities that have to go to work, that are driving your buses, that are cleaning your floors, that are doing all of this work. And then we have to put up with the utter nonsense of saying, people then turn around saying, we need to look into why this is affecting people of color by more than you know. And you're going, it's nothing to do with people of color. It's to do with socioeconomic class and how, where they're actually working. So yeah, no, I do.
But and again, there was a brilliant thing today, Tony, right? There's a problem now, because people, like I said, people are now feeling that, oh, you know, it's, what's the worst that could happen, right? So they're starting to go back to work. Public transport here was dead. I remember talking to Eamon Dunphy one day. He rang me when I was sitting on the underground here, and there was nobody in the carriage, right? And this is the middle of the day on a Wednesday, where normally it wouldn't be full, but, you know, there'd be quite a few people in the carriage, and there wasn't a sinner out, you know? But now they're saying that, oh, you know, there's a lot of people on the buses, there's a lot of people on public transport, what are we going to do about it? So, you know, if you like, the sort of the equivalent of the Irish Independent had an editorial today, and they were saying, well, what we should do is, in the short term, we should double the price of the tickets, and that's going to stop people getting on public transport. Who uses public transport, Tony? Who uses it?
Exactly.
Fucking poor people who need to go to work, you know? And so not only are you sort of taking more money out of their pocket, you're making it more difficult for them to go to work. And it's that kind of magical thinking, you know, that... And this is the problem, that I know I'm privileged, lads. I get to travel the world doing what I love doing. I get to do this, to talk to fellas like yourselves, and to think about things, and to tease things out, and to interview interesting people, and to have these experiences. I know that. And I'm fucking aware of it, that when I get into a taxi from the airport here, and I try to talk to the man or woman who's driving me, because I know, like, I've met so many people who are dentists. There was actually a guy that was a photographer for one of the outlets that I used to work with in Iraq. And when he moved to Sweden, he couldn't get a job as a photographer. The only job he had was a taxi driver here, and he was 6 years driving a taxi, couldn't get a job in his profession, and an absolutely brilliant photographer. You want to see the stuff on his Instagram, right? So I know how privileged I am as a white, you know, middle class man living in a working class area. But, you know, that sort of magical thing, he goes, well, let's just double the ticket prices and we'll protect them all. Get the fuck out of here.
Well, we're not far behind you. I'm gonna bring us on to the big thing you talk about, traveling the world, Philip. I think it's important that our listeners understand you are trying to set yourself a big challenge, and it is a very big challenge. It's about covering the American presidential election, which is, you know, there's always, people always use big phrases like, this is always the most important, this is always the biggest thing, everything's always the biggest thing. But this truly is possibly the most important election of our generation anyway. Do you want to give us an idea of what the challenge is you want to set for yourself?
Yeah, let me set the scene to you, Tony, right? I went over to see Conor McGregor fighting Eddie Alvarez in November 2016, and that happened to be the same week as the presidential election. So when the UFC have a lot of fights, that, you know, you arrive usually on the Monday or the Tuesday in America. Monday is better if it's Vegas, because you get screwed up in the jet lag. So I arrived in New York for this fight, and it just happened to be on the Tuesday of the election. So I arrived into Manhattan, you know, around about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd already decided that I was going to do some stuff for a news agency whilst I was there. And that was great. So I met a journalist friend of mine, a Swedish journalist friend of mine, in the Midtown Hilton Hotel in Manhattan. And Donald Trump was like a few floors above me with his people, right? And they started coming down to the bar. We were sitting in the bar just waiting, watching the TV, seeing what was going to happen here, thinking, okay, what are we going to do? Is there going to be any work for us at all to do? Or is he just going to say, oh, you know, I fought the good fight and that's the end of it? And we thought, yeah, it was fascinating, because my friend had traveled from Vegas to New York. They'd just driven sort of Route 66 kind of thing straight across the country. And he said, no, I think Trump's going to win it. I said, well, how? I said, you know, because everything I'm hearing coming out of the media here is that Hillary's got it, you know, that kind of thing. He said, no. He said, you talk to the people in middle America, they'll tell you a different story from what you're hearing in international media. And I went, fair enough. And then Florida fell, and the two of us looked at each other.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like that scene in Heat, you know, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And I just fucking ran down to Times Square because we knew at that stage that Trump was going to win it. And the thing that struck me, and the thing that I've been thinking about ever since, Tony, was how did we all get it so wrong? How did the whole world not see this coming, right? And when you look back, it's pretty obvious now, you know, but I think we're still in that situation. So if we roll it on 4 years, my business, such as it is, freelance runners, have basically collapsed, right? Loads of my friends have been made redundant in the meantime. And as a freelancer, I'm dependent on my ideas and dependent on having something to do every day to try to make money, right? So I had this idea that I'm not going to let the same thing happen again, right? And the way I'm going to go about it is I'm going to go to America and I'm going to visit all 50 states in the 50 days leading up to Poland Day on November 3rd, and I'm going to do 50 podcasts, right? One podcast from each state. And in that way, I'm not going to look for celebrities. I'm not going to go talking to, you know, LeBron James, or I'm not going to go talking to anybody like that. I'm going to go to a diner. I'm going to go to a gas station. I'm going to go to a gym. I'm going to go to a shooting range. I'm going to go to wherever, like a baseball game, and just talk to ordinary people, right? The very people that this podcast is actually aimed at, the kind of people who never get a platform to say anything anywhere. Because one of the things that I learned in America was that if you talk to people and you ask them a question, they'll tell you what they think, right? Mm. You may not like it, but they're going to tell you what they think. So I came up with this idea. And to be honest, I spent about 3 or 4 months working this idea out, because I've had it basically since the election 4 years ago. I was thinking this might be something that I could do. I'd be a little bit contrarian like Martin in this way, right? So as soon as I see it, this couldn't be worse timing, right? The media business is on its fucking knees. Nobody has money for sponsorship or that kind of thing. And yet I just will not let this lie. I feel I have to do it, lads, because I want to go out there. I want to talk to people. And on polling day, no matter what the result is, I want the people to listen to this series, which is called Outside It's America. I want them to be able to say, well, that didn't surprise me one bit. I listened to those 50 shows and I knew exactly what the American people were going to do. And one last thing on that was that this guy contacted me, and you know, he sort of set himself up as being a sort of a podcasting guru and that kind of thing. And he, you know, he's a great man to do a bit of mansplaining and to offer you an opinion where you don't actually fucking want to hear what he has to say. Where he's gone, why not just do 15 states because they have all the power? I've gone, that's the fucking point, right? His actual thing was, who cares about Delaware? I'll tell you who cares about Delaware, Tony. I care about Delaware. I care because I have no idea what the people in that state think. I have no idea what they have suffered or what they have gained by 4 years of Trump. I have no idea what's going on there at all. And again, with the greatest respect, Tony, neither have you, neither does Martin, neither does anybody else. And I'm going to take that blank spot in our knowledge and I'm going to turn that into something that we all know about so that we will have a greater understanding of what's going to be happening for the next 4 years when I'm done.
I think it's really admirable, because I do, as someone who kind of, you know, if you remember, what was it, Keep It 1600 was the podcast at the time. It was the boys that were working with Bill Simmons, and they were telling us that, you know, Hillary's going to win, and we'll all be, you know, Obama will reign forever via surrogates and what struck me is, and it's a phrase someone says, yes, progress is inevitable, but it's not always forward.
Exactly.
We've been hit with that, but with a slap around the head for the last 4 years, with be it Brexit, be it Trump, be it Boris Johnson, be it the, you know, Dominic Cummings, be it some of the stuff that's happening in our own country in terms of homelessness that we never thought we'd see, and you know, levels like
but
that.
But this is the thing, Tony. Like, one of the things that's happened in Ireland and surprised me as well is if you look at what the media said and the outcome of the two referenda that we've had in Ireland recently, right? And the media's gone, oh, it's very close. Oh, it's very, it fucking wasn't close at all, right? Yeah. Who are you talking to? Who are you people talking to that you can get it this wrong, right?
And, well, they are talking. It's a small group of people. It's a small circle. They go to school together. They socialize together. Now, I don't mean that for everybody. There are outliers, but the particularly the Polcors. That's a tight-knit group.
Well, we had to hear for months that it was just a question of whether it was going to be Michal or Leo.
And I know you said you didn't see Trump coming. I saw Trump coming, and I said it before he got in there. I also saw this election that we just had and said it before the results were called. There's a lot of, and Tony uses this phrase a lot, left behind people who are left behind, whether it's in America, the UK, or here. They are left behind. And sooner or later, they reach a critical mass where they say, well, fuck you. And the fuck you can be a bad fuck you or a good fuck you. But it's the left behinds who are making the decisions.
They'll even vote against their own interests just to kick.
Of course they will. Of course they will.
And this is the funny thing, lads, because like I spent 20 years covering the rise of the far right in Scandinavia, right? I've seen the Sweden Democrats doubling their vote every election, four elections in a row. And I've seen these mechanics. And again, Martin, like I kind of thought that it could happen with Trump, but I didn't think it would, right? I was a lot less sure or a lot less, you know, I thought if Hillary was going to win, she was only going to edge it. And in the end, you know, okay, she won the popular vote. But the whole thing with American politics is, and you know, one of these things that I've been listening to a lot lately is like there's like a 24-hour lecture series about the American Civil War, right? And America is basically set up for this brinksmanship and always has been. So when you went back to, as states were acceding to the Union, they would take in slave states and free states two at a time, right? So that balance was never threatened. The balance of the Senate was never threatened. It was always going to be one. So it's supposed to be this brinksmanship the whole time, and the squeeze middle in inverted commas is what actually gets to the side, right? But there's so many of those things. As you were saying, the forgotten people, the people who are the left behind people, they're the people who nobody talks to, right? And like, I honestly want to hear from those people. You know, I want to go to these places and to find out these places, because everywhere has them. You know, every state has something to be proud of. You know, there's a whole bunch of tiny little states there in the northeastern corner, and they're all the same, but very, very different, right? So in Massachusetts, you have tremendous wealth in Massachusetts, going back to the late 1700s, right? But you also have enormous poverty in parts of this. Look at Oakland, right? You have in Silicon Valley and San Francisco, you have the biggest tech companies in the world. But if you go across, like across the bridge into Oakland, California, and the level of homelessness I saw there just about a year and a half, 2 years ago, lads, it's staggering, you know? And then this like anti-homeless architecture, all these things. And I'm literally going into this, not as somebody who is thinking, oh, look at Americans, aren't they stupid and that kind of thing. I'm literally wiping my mind clean of everything I know about it, right? It's like, you know, your first day in university, not that I ever went, you know, any university education I have was done by distance, but it's like walking into the quad and Trinners, right? And not knowing anything. I'm a blank sheet of paper here, and I'm going to let these people write their story on me or tell their story through me. And I'll give you an example of it. Like a few years ago, I was going over to Las Vegas. Again, it was probably the UFC or boxing that I was lucky enough to be covering. And I met this man named Angus, right? And Angus is this man with massive tribal tattoos on his arms, huge bald head, beard, biker. And he's a gun instructor for the NRA, the National Rifle Association, right? His people were Scottish people, but big into this thing of American freedom and don't tell me what to do and that kind of thing, right? But he was an instructor for the NRA. And I thought, okay, I have to talk to this bloke. But if I just sit down and start doing the whole Sandy Hook, guns are wrong, et cetera, I'm not going to learn anything. So I said to him, okay, take me to a range and teach me how to shoot, right? And in the car, we recorded a conversation where he explained this thing to me, right? Now, at certain times, right, if you're going to get people on whatever, you know, Virgin are doing instead of Vincent Brown now, you know, that's a time to be confrontational because you're holding people to account. I wasn't holding Angus to account. I just wanted him to explain his feeling about guns and firearms and freedom and how linked all these things are to me, right? And he did it, and it was brilliant. I still don't agree with the man. Like, not a single thing he said could I agree with, but I understand now what he thinks. I shared it on SoundCloud, but the problem was I put a bit of Aerosmith music in it, and Aerosmith made me take it down. So I haven't been able to use that ever since, you know? But that to me was, like, this is what I mean when I say, if you want to know what American people think, fucking ask them, because they'll tell you. And I'm looking forward to talking to maybe 200 or 300 Anguses from all sides. I want to hear from people who have been affected by police violence. People of color have been affected. Black people have been affected by police violence. I want to talk to people, white soccer moms who are afraid to go out at night. I want to talk to literally everybody, from millionaires to crack addicts, the whole lot. And I'll go and I'll find them. I'll burn that shoe leather doing this, because I feel that I owe it to you guys, and I owe it to listeners, and I owe it to people, and I owe it to the people whose stories I'll be telling to put those things out there, so that we're never surprised again. You know, it is the podcast of the forgotten is what it's going to be. And one other point, I'm not going to chase the candidates. If they happen to show up somewhere and I happen to be there, that's fine. But the rest of the world, the New York Times and Sky News and CNN, MSNBC and the Washington Post and RTE and everybody else, they can go do the thing, sit there, you know, be spat at by Trump supporters or be lauded by Biden supporters. I don't care. None of what they say, everything they say is going to make it into your newspaper or onto your website. Anyway, I go to talk to the people who have absolutely not the slightest, a snowball's chance in hell of being heard anywhere else but in what I'm doing.
Can I just say, okay, this obviously... bring it back to where this conversation started. As a freelance, Philip, people need to understand that listeners, and this is me giving the pitch, you need support to do this. We rely on support. I mean, you know, this is, you know, you don't want to put yourself into hock for this, mate. It's a big ask. Is there ways? I know. Sure, look, you're going the Kickstarter route. Yeah. Are we looking? You know, realistically, people get behind this. People can do this, and we're hoping to get some momentum behind it. You know.
Yeah, well, so far, Tony, I've actually been amazed, right? So I sort of thought that the easiest thing to do, obviously always the easiest thing to do, is to find one company, get them to commission it, you know? I would have loved if Spotify had come in and said, look, we'll take this off your hands and go. They never got back to me. A couple of other platforms are kind of interested, but they won't put up the whole thing. So I said, you know what? Instead of going for these huge, huge companies, let's go the other way. Let's go to people. And the pitch I've been making, and there's a bunch of rewards on Kickstarter, but the only one I ever talk about is one that costs 10 euros, because people can get their heads around it, you know? It's, you know, it's I think it's only about 40% of the cost of a brunch in Berlin D2, you know? So, I mean, it's the kind of thing that everybody is able to afford, it would seem, right? But by going the crowdfunding route, there's a couple of things I learned, right? One is that Swedish people are very much, our Swedish journalist colleagues are very much looking down on me for doing this, as if I'm going around with a begging bowl. No, lads, this is the way things have to be, right? The media business has changed, right? And it has to be, it's down to people who actually really feel like a project is worth supporting. They will support you if you find enough of them to do it, right? I'm not going to get any of the major media houses here. And this place has the same conglomerates as, you know, Ireland. We all know who owns the newspapers and the radio stations there. And that's great, right? I have the same things here. I'm not even going near them, right? But to have journalists sort of looking at you, you know, because obviously I'm looking to be amplified at the moment, right? Mm. And to have people sort of not doing that, just ghosting me and ignoring me, that tells me that they're looking down on me because of what it is I'm trying to do, right? But the Kickstarter thing has been brilliant. I think, you know, it's only launched about a week ago, and without too much publicity, it's over 3,000 euro at the moment, right?
That's now, brilliant.
It's fantastic, right? Now, the target is 50, right? Because the insurance is fucking through the roof, and traveling around America is going to be pretty expensive, and then you have to have a few quid left over. But you know what, lads? With sort of 22 days left, I'm actually hugely confident, because the exponential effect is what I'm looking for here. Right. And one of the things that I've been asking people today on various social platforms is, I don't care. I'm going the blind boy route here, right? I don't care if you can contribute or not, because the pods are going to be out there for everywhere. It is the soundness model. But if you can't, or even if you can, just tag five people who you think might be interested in it and get them to tag five in turn. And, you know, this could be done by Friday if everybody I know or everybody I ever played football with or everybody I ever annoyed in Fine Gael could do that, right? This would be done by then, because, you know, the concept, 50 pods, 50 states, 50 days, people I go, fucking yes, yes, give me loads of that, you know? And I do think that people trust me to tell the stories and to have a bit of crack on the road. So it's just getting out there and getting close enough. Now, there's sponsor packages out there for episodes, and you can get shout outs, and there's all that kind of thing. I'm actually going to do one now for radio stations, right? So they have things called phoners, right? So if you have a radio station, you can call me up 10 times. But what I'm asking you to do is, rather than pay me for each of those separately when you do them, just pay me in advance. Put it into the Kickstarter and make the project happen, right?
So if
they can guarantee that, you know, and I'll talk to people, you know, who have the resources to do those things. If you get 10 of them, that's $5,000. Fantastic, you know? So it's an awful lot of hard work. What kind of... not upsets me, but what kind of annoys me at the moment is that I have to spend so much time selling. I'm not a fucking salesman, lads, right?
It's just, clearly.
No, but that's not where my heart is. My heart is, I want to be putting the microphone under the nose of people. I think that all the time that I could be spending, you know, drafting posts on LinkedIn, I could be talking to a female soccer player in Barcelona or a female soccer player here in Sweden about why they're getting like 3.8 million crowns, which is just under 400,000 euros, while the men's game is getting about 17 million during the pandemic. I'd rather be talking and writing about that, but I can't, because I have to make sure this happens, because this is going to save, you know, this is going to pay me for the 3 or 4 months of work that I put into it already, plus the time that I'm going to be out there, you know? So that's where it's at the moment. And I literally am, like, if I can get that snowball, and the decent people that listen to this podcast, right, they are activist people. They are people who do shit, right? And they get things done. And, you know, through you guys, and I'm so grateful to you for the platform, lads. I'm always grateful to you for the platform to talk about these things and the experience that I've had. But to say to them, look, go out and help me on this one, because I find it really, really difficult as a journalist. I find it really difficult as a man, let alone as a journalist, to hold up my hand and ask for help, right? But I'm doing it now. And if people can help me, and if they can amplify me, and you know what has turned out to be key, and you'll find this with your own Patreon as well, lads, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You'll find the recommendation is key, right? Yeah. So it's not just retweeting something. If Martin goes out and says, I know this fella, he's a gobshite, but the work he does is really, really good, and I trust him to do a good job here, I can see 5 minutes later that two or three of Martin's buddies that he drinks pints of the Gravediggers with will be in there. Oh, sorry, that's Tony's buddies. You know, but they get their shit and they'll put it into this project. And it is, it's a networking thing. Yeah. And, you know, the final thing on networking, LinkedIn is a pile of shite.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever come across anything? It's just desperate, lads. Honestly,
but listen, it's up on Kickstarter. The link will be attached to the podcast. It's called Outside It's America. Please, if you can, right? Forget about our Patreon for a few minutes, please. And just see if we... Because honestly, these are the sort of things that we should all be excited about, because it is going about talking
like
about things.
I'm so jealous of you going off and doing something like that. I'm genuinely jealous. I'd love to do something like that, to go and do 50 states in 50 days and talk to people from all over. I think it's admirable. I think it's interesting, and I definitely think that you should get enough people to fund it.
I really hope to. Have you listened to the trailer?
I did, Martin. No, Martin hasn't heard it. Martin doesn't listen to anything but his own voice.
It's technology. I forgot about that. Yeah.
The
trailer is up there on Kickstarter, and there's going to be a new video coming out next week, because this is like, as part of the campaign, you keep doing sort of updates and trying to encourage people to get more and more people involved. So the new video will go up there that'll give people an idea of what they can expect.
Listen, we're going to leave it there, but if you have any spare change kicking about, or you just think that this is a project you're interested in, and you're fed up like me of listening to Pod Save America and getting the same basically West Coast guys, and no offense to the lads, they're lovely guys and all the rest of it, but it's they keep every time they talk about Obama, they refer to as our boss, and it just does my head in, you know. It's like our boss Obama, our boss. It's like, no, let's have a real voice out there that we can actually listen to without wanting to pull our hair out, what little hair we have left. Philip O'Connor, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Philip.
Thanks so much, lads. I really appreciate it.
Talk to you soon, folks.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.